world I'd always dreamed about. The mowed grass and the grassy trail led to the pine woods and to an opening in the pine woods, like a room or an alcove, a little cove. It was the kind of place young people might dance on a spring afternoon, surrounded by pine trees and with white clouds overhead. I looked through the doorway and seen that the sky was clear except for the white clouds. And there was another trail beyond the grassy alcove, a trail that led off into the pine trees and up a hill. It was a path inviting me to follow it. It was a path that was alive, a path I could feel along with my feet, even if my eyes was closed. It was a path that led right on up toward the lip of the hill, to the edge of the sky. It was the trail into heaven. One step at a time, I could walk there, through the doorway into the evening light, on the cool grass. When I woke up, Hank was bending over me with a cup of warm tea. The steam off the cup made my cheeks sweat. "Have a taste of this," he said. "Am I better?" I said. I remembered the shining doorway I'd seen the night before. "Your fever has gone down," Hank said. "Then I'm better," I said. "Fevers always go down in the morning," Hank said, "and then they go up again in the evening." "How is the baby?" I said. "The baby is so weak I can't feed it nothing but a sugar tit and milk in an eyedropper," Hank said. "Then I ought to nurse it," I said. "You can't," Hank said. I felt the emptiness in my breasts. "I want to see the baby," I said. "The baby is too delicate to move," Hank said. "I'm keeping her in a shoebox by the fire." "I want to see her," I said. "You just need to rest," Hank said. When Hank was gone, I looked for the lighted doorway in the bedroom wall, but seen only the wall where coats and overalls hung on pegs. Yet when I closed my eyes and looked through the squint of eyelashes, I seen the bright threshold. It was there all the time if you just looked at it right, like stars in the sky at noon if you can see them. I closed my eyes and listened to the things outside the house. There was a dove calling somewhere in the woods across the creek. It was like the note when you blow across the mouth of a bottle. It was like a note coming out of a cave in a mountain. Hank was getting clothes together in the kitchen to take out to the wash pot. He had made a fire under the wash pot and carried water from the spring to fill the cauldron and the tubs. As far as I knowed, Hank had never washed clothes before. "The water is coming to a boil," Hank called. "I hate to leave that baby for a minute." "You can't take the baby outside," I said. "I'm afraid if I turn my back, it'll quit breathing," Hank said. "It's in the hands of the Lord," I said. But I didn't know if I was talking in my head or really talking to Hank. I couldn't tell the difference no more. I could hear him talking like I was in the room with him. I heard Hank carry the clothes out to the wash pot, and I heard him singing to himself as he stirred the clothes in the boiling water with the troubling stick. Hank had never washed clothes before, but now he had no choice. He was singing "By Jordan's Stormy Banks." He sung several verses and choruses while he troubled the hot water and then lifted the clothes out with the stick, streaming and steaming, and slopped them down on the washboard. Hank left the baby in the shoebox on the chair by the fireplace while he done the washing and split more wood at the woodpile. I heard the chop of the axe and then the hack of the echo coming back from the ridge across the creek. Chop, hack, it went. Chop, hack, chop, hack. His axe was making music, and the dove was making music. Everything was making its own music. The dust in the air was music, and the clouds in the sky was music. And the baby's little cry was music that hurt. When next I woke up, I was shivering. It was cold like ice water was pouring through the hollows of my bones, and there was ice in the sockets of my joints. My teeth chattered and my elbows jerked. Hank bent over me and said, "You've got the chills." He wrapped the quilts tighter around me, but the quilts felt thin as muslin that let a cold wind through. There was nothing between me and the ice at the North Pole. "Drink this," Hank said. He held a cup of hot tea to my lips. There was fumes coming from the tea. It was part whiskey. My jaw shook so I couldn't hardly put my lips to the glass. I swallowed a trickle of tea, and it went down my throat like a lizard of fire. It crawled in my belly and curled up in a nest of glowing coals. I took another sip, and the nest of coals got bigger. "Drink all of it," Hank said. I took another sip and swallowed. The hot herb tea made me shiver even worser. "Shivering shows you're still alive," somebody had said. I shuddered and jerked from one end of the bed to the other. My breasts was empty, but I wanted to hold the baby, but I couldn't even keep my arms still. I tried to lay still, and my back jerked and rippled. My bones felt like they was rattling against each other. As the warm juice in my belly started spreading, carrying its lights through veins and bones to my toes and fingertips, I stopped jerking a little. I laid back on the pillows and seen the door in the wall of the bedroom. It was warm evening light coming through the door, on the grass and among the pine trees. Somebody was calling to me on the path, just beyond where I could see. Now I could think two things at the same time. I could hear Hank in the living room, talking, as he awkwardly lifted the diaper and gown from the baby and sponged the little body off with a piece of flannel cloth. The baby was so little, a regular diaper almost covered it up. The skin was too delicate to rub. Hank just touched it with a wet flannel, the way he might wash a sore place or a wound. He touched the baby like he was almost afraid to touch her. "Be a miracle if this baby lives," Hank said. "It's a miracle any baby lives," I said. But I didn't know if I was just talking in my head. I couldn't nurse the baby. I had failed her. It was night outside the window where Hank was. Night pressed against the house and made it feel little. But through the door in the wall of the bedroom come the light of a summer evening. Birds was singing in the golden trees, and the grass was warm from the sun. You could tell where the path in the grass was because it was sunk a little. The trail wound off into the pines and up the hill. "Julie," somebody called among the trees, beyond where I could see. Who could be calling me out into the late evening sun, into the woods where the sun didn't reach? I wondered if I should get out of bed. I'd laid still so long I was weak, and my legs felt like they was froze. If I had such a fever as Hank had said, should I get out from under the covers and walk outside? "Are you coming, Julie?" the voice called. And at the same time, I heard Hank talking from the living room. "I've heard of giving a baby ginseng tea to stimulate its heart," he said. "Ginseng tea is too strong for a baby," I called. "I wouldn't give it nothing stronger than pennyroyal tea." "You could give it a smaller dose or a weaker dose," Hank said. He sprinkled talcum on the little girl and slid a diaper under her. Hank worked careful, barely touching the delicate skin. The baby was so soft, a touch could bruise it. The skin was softer than a rose petal and would break just as easy. After he got the diaper under the baby, Hank laid the ends across the belly and pinned them. He held one diaper pin in his mouth while he snapped the other into place. Hank's hands was too big for that kind of work, but he was doing his best. I seen there was things about Hank I couldn't have guessed. He was talking to the baby. "She a pretty girl. Now ain't she a pretty girl?" Hank was saying. "Prettiest girl in the world. Ain't got a name, pretty little thing." But while I heard Hank talking, almost singing to the baby, I could hear the voice calling from the pine trees also. "Julie," it said, "I want to show you something." Whose voice was it? It sounded so familiar. Julie, it called. I want you to come out where I can see you. Suddenly I knowed it was Papa's voice. I hadn't noticed that before, for it wasn't Papa's voice when he was old, but when he was young. It was his voice as a young man, when he first met Mama. He was calling to me in the voice of his youth. He was calling to me across the summer grass from the pine woods. I'm not supposed to walk, I called back. You can walk, Papa said, almost like a kid calling me out to play. I lifted the covers aside and got out of bed. My legs were stronger than I had thought they was. I had to walk slow, but I was steady. I took short steps to the door and walked out into the grass. It was a world for a picnic out there. I'd never seen a place so perfect. The grass was warm and trimmed smooth. The world was a park, a garden. It was like the world must have been in the beginning. There was bushes that smelled like perfume and flame azaleas in bloom. There was little bluets along the edges of the grass. It was grass you wanted to sit down on. It was grass you wanted to lay back on and watch the clouds pass over. Papa called to me again, but he was further out in the woods than I had thought. Are you coming, Julie? He said. It was like he had gone for a walk on the path up the mountainside and was waiting for me. We was going for a stroll on the trail that wound off through the pine trees to the edge of the sky. But in the living room, Hank was still talking to the baby. He laid a white flannel blanket over her up to her chin. This little girl will live till the end of the century, Hank said. She will live to see the end of time. For preachers say the world will come to an end at the end of the millennium. This little girl will start out in a shoebox by the fireplace and live to see Jesus bust out of the eastern sky in all his glory. How can time come to an end? I said in my head. It will come to an end when the word is fulfilled, Hank said. Time can't end, for what would follow would be time too, I said. Don't you believe the Bible? Hank said. Don't you know it says plain in Revelation that time will stop? But what comes after that will be more time, I said. The baby cried a little cry. It was a cry small as a bird might make. It was small as the memory of a cry. She was crying, and I couldn't feed her. You are walking on sacred ground, the voice in the pines called to me. I'm walking barefoot, I said. Only a few more steps, the voice called. But it was now further up the trail. The voice was in the shadows under the pine trees. The pines had purple and green shadows. The grassy path wound deeper into the trees. Now it was like there was music coming out of everything I looked at. The glowing grass under my feet had its own music, and the shadows blowed out deep organ music. I knowed the music was in my head, but it was seeing the wonderful world of grass and pine grove that made me think the music. There was music coming from under the ground so deep it hurt my bones and stirred through my guts. Everything had a different voice, but the voices all harmonized like a congregation at church. Julie, the voice called as I stepped into the alcove among the pine trees. It was a little dancing yard. A little cove. I looked for Papa's figure, but there was nobody there. The woods was lit with the evening sun, but I didn't see nobody. It was the kind of place where you expected to see a burning bush. I walked over the soft grass as easy as gliding. Papa? I called to the path going up the hill. There was nobody in sight among the pines, and nobody answered. But I thought I heard somebody speak, or maybe it was a dove calling. I stepped up the path knowing there was somebody waiting, for I had heard the voice call my name. The music was in my head, but the voice come from the pine trees. Papa? I called again. But when I come around to turn in the path, there was nobody there. Please, Jesus, I whispered, let me talk to Papa. Julie, the voice said again, and it sounded close by, but above me. I hurried up the grassy trail and seen the top of the hill was bare. It was covered with grass, and a bright white cloud hung so close it appeared to lean against the top of the hill. It looked like I could step from the path right onto the shining cloud. Papa? I called, but I didn't see anybody on top of the hill. There was just me and the sky and the white cloud. Julie, the voice said behind me. I turned, and where there hadn't been anybody before, stood a young man that looked a little bit like Papa. He had a reddish-blonde beard and hair. He was wearing a white shirt, and he had slender shoulders and the whitest skin you ever seen. Don't you know me? He said. I think I know you, I said. I was standing on the top of the world, and there was nobody there but him and me, and the shining cloud almost at my elbow. I have come to show you my love, he said. Why have you come to me? I said. I felt how shameful I was. I hadn't even been able to nurse my baby. Because you have shown the truest love, Papa said. How? I said. My knees were shaking. Because you have loved others more than yourself, he said. I done what I had to, I said. You are one of the blessed, he said. What kind of dream am I dreaming? I said. But Papa didn't answer. He turned and walked further up the grassy hill. I was afraid he might just melt away into the light. He looked so slim and starved. I was afraid he would vanish before I could find out why he had come to me. There were things I wanted to ask Papa, things I would never get a chance to ask again. Will I live? I said. I have come to tell you. You will live, Papa said. You will live, and you will continue to work and to love. That sounds simple, I said. Simple and hard. They was two words that fit my life, the life I had lived. Ever since I could remember, the work had been hard, work I often hated. I looked for Papa, but he wasn't on top of the hill. I looked behind me, but there was nothing but pine trees and grass there. The cloud had floated away and hung far out over the valley. I wanted to ask if the baby will live, I called. But there was only the whisper of air around me. I stood on the hill until the light begun to fade. Far to the edge of the world, I thought I seen a star come out like a crystal. It was time for me to start back down the hill. I heard the baby crying in the living room. I'll put some extra wood on the fire, Hank said. It's near bedtime, I said. Never mind what time it is, Hank said. I'm going to make some more tea for the baby. What kind of tea? I said. I'm going to put a little chamomile in it, Hank said, to help the baby sleep, to hush it up from crying. I felt how warm and damp the sheet was around me. The quilt pressed down its warmth close to my sweaty skin. I reached a hand from under the covers and touched my forehead. My skin was wet with sweat and cool, but I could smell the sickness on my hand, the smell of old flesh that has been cooked by fever and needs scrubbing. I was dripping with sweat. Chapter 13. Hank did go after Ma Richards after my fever went down, and Ma Richards helped me take care of the baby while I was getting my strength back. Ma Richards complained, but she helped me with little Delia like she was her own baby. I'll have to give Ma that. But it didn't do no good. The child had been born too early. She was too little to be able to live on cow's milk and sugar water and the gruel Ma Richards made. It broke my heart to see how tiny Delia was and how she wouldn't gain any weight. Her fingers and toes was tinier than match heads. Her little arms was the size of my fingers. Taking care of Delia wasn't like taking care of another sick baby, where you hold it and rock it and give it tonic and warm milk. Delia was so tiny, you didn't dare hold her upright. She was so weak, you didn't want to move her no more than you had to. And she was so delicate, you was afraid you'd break her skin or arm just by taking her up. "The Lord will let this baby live," I said, "if it's His will." "The Lord has His own plans for people," Ma Richard said, in her way that always irritated me. "But we can still ask for what we want," I said. "We can ask," Ma said, "but that don't mean the Lord has to answer." I'd been feeling better about Ma Richards as I got stronger. But maybe because I had decided to like Ma more, my guard was down. Before, I had been extra careful whenever she was around and held myself back because I disliked her so much. Now, anger rose right out of my guts and filled my mouth. "I guess you know all the Lord's secrets," I said. I sounded like Mama when she was mad. It just come out and I didn't try to stop it. Ma Richards was folding diapers on the kitchen table. She stopped and looked at me. She wasn't used to people talking back to her. She certainly wasn't used to me talking back to her. "I try to tell the truth," Ma said. "Why should the Lord show you the truth more than anybody else?" I said. I could feel a shadow in the air around me, like the daylight was haunted. I'd never gone so far quarreling with anybody, except maybe Lou. But I didn't want to stop myself until I'd gone farther still. It felt good to talk angry. "I've learned a few things in my years," Ma said, "and one of the things I've learned is how foolish the young can be when they won't take advice." "The only advice you want to give is to run things," I said. I'd gone that far. I might as well go on farther. Ma Richards went back to folding diapers. She finished one and started folding another. There was a grin on her face, like she had been waiting a long time for a fuss, and nobody had obliged her. "Throwing off on me won't make the baby no better," Ma said. "You don't care what happens, as long as you can be the queen bee," I said. My voice was shriller than I wanted it to be. "I care enough to come down here and work day and night to take care of you," Ma said. I wanted to drive her out of the kitchen. I wanted to fold the diapers myself. I grabbed a diaper off the pile and started to fold it. Hank was out at the barn, and I didn't want him to hear me quarreling with Ma Richards. "You don't think nobody knows how to do anything but you," I said. Now that my tongue was loose, it just seemed to go of its own accord. "What's wrong with you, Julie?" Ma said. "You must be out of your head." "I believe in respecting old people," I said. "But I never run into anybody like you before." "Hank don't seem to mind the kind of person I am," Ma Richards said. "You've been bossing him around all his life," I said. "He's a good man, or he wouldn't have put up with it." I figured I might as well tell the truth while I was at it. "You are the cause of most of his troubles." "What troubles?" Ma said. "The way he gets discouraged and can't find a job," I said. "Now you want to blame me for the way the world is?" Ma said. "I blame you for the way Hank's world is," I said. "You have got on a high horse all of a sudden," Ma said. She reached for another diaper to fold, but I picked it up before she could touch it. "You're not used to people telling you the truth," I said. "I ain't done nothing to be ashamed of," Ma said. "At least nothing to you." "I don't care what you do to me," I said. "It's the way you run over Hank that riles me." "Hank has told you that?" Ma said. "He didn't need to," I said. "I've got eyes in my head." "Some women get afraid they can't hold a man, and that makes them mean," Ma said. "I reckon you're one of them." Tears come to my eyes. I couldn't help it. Suddenly everything in the room blurred and melted. It seemed Ma was smirking at me. I just wish you would mind your own devilment, I said. It's a common weakness to blame other people for our own shortcomings, Ma said, and laughed a dry laugh. You're mighty used to having the last word, I said, my voice rising toward a scream. Maybe that bothers you because you're afraid of everything, Ma said. It's my house, I screamed. But even as I screamed, I wished I hadn't done it. I'd gone too far. I felt like Ma had tricked me into getting mad and screaming at her. Even though she had helped me with the baby while I was recovering, she had tricked me into losing my temper. Julie, I don't know what's got into you, Ma said. But she said it like it was for somebody else's benefit. I guess that Hank must have come into the kitchen while I was screaming. I turned around, and there he stood in the door with a look of surprise. Even with my tears stretching and swelling everything, I could see the fear on his face. What's wrong? Hank said, like he was short of breath. Julie is upset, Ma said. I've a right to be upset, I said. But I wished I hadn't, for it wouldn't do no good to try to set Hank against Ma. He would never turn against her, and she would make it look like the quarrel was all my fault. Has the baby got worse? Hank said. I've done everything I could to help, Ma Richard said. I seen what a mistake it had been to let myself go. But there was one last breath of rage left in me. You've done everything you could to make me look bad, I said to Ma. I've done everything I could to help you, Ma said. She has beat me by sounding meek, I thought. Hank looked at Ma, and he looked at me. He stepped forward and put a hand on my shoulder, and he put his other hand on Ma's shoulder. Let's get right down on our knees and pray about this, he said. We're a family, and we've got to live like a family. The fizz and bite of rage was going out of me. The boldness that had took over my tongue melted away. I sunk down on my knees to the kitchen floor, and Hank put his arm around me and his other arm around Ma Richards. Lord, help us to love each other, Hank said. Teach us to put aside our spites and grudges, our slights and hurt feelings. Teach us to put away our vanity and our pride. Help us to be the decent people we are deep inside. He pulled me closer on the left side and Ma closer on the right. I couldn't look Ma in the face, and I don't reckon she could bear to look me in the face either. I stared down at the floor. I want you all to kiss each other, Hank said. I didn't make a move, and I didn't say nothing. I reckon my lip was trembling. We're going to have to get beyond this, Hank said. There's no hope for a family that quarrels all the time. I'd never heard Hank talk so dignified and wise. It was usually him losing his temper and me holding mine. But here he was sounding like a deacon that led in prayer and was the head of the family. His calm moved me more than anything else had. I felt proud that he was a man I could rely on and trust. He was not only the father of my baby who had took care of the baby, but he could show me what to do when I got all worked up and beside myself with disappointment and resentment. It was like Hank had got a lot older. I reached over and put my arms around Ma Richard's bony shoulders and kissed her on the cheek. Another sob rose and broke in my throat. I'm sorry, I said. I love you, Julie, she said, and I seen the tears streaming down Ma's wrinkled face. I felt she meant it, that she was telling the truth. There was no sass and no edge in her voice. I sobbed again and snuffed up my nose and wiped my eyes. My cheeks was wet like I'd been out in the rain. I felt wrung out on the inside, but scrubbed and sweetened too. The world was firm again. That's when I heard little Delia crying the faintest cry. I'll go see about her, Ma Richard said. I'll go too, I said. The baby was getting weaker instead of growing. It appeared she was losing weight. Her skin was so white it looked clear, Blue veins showed through like ink marks under her skin. "She's awful weak," I said. "Bless her little heart," Ma said. "Ain't there no medicine for an early baby?" I said. "The doctor just said give her milk and sugar and a little barley water," Hank said. "Her belly's too young to take anything," Ma said. "They give babies paregoric for colic," Hank said. "I'd hate to give one so little paregoric," I said. Delia wasn't squealing like a baby usually does with colic. She just laid there, fretting and whimpering, and she didn't have a temperature either. There was no sign of a fever. There's nothing that makes you feel as helpless as a baby that's sick. It's your job to do something about it, but you don't know what. I was just getting back on my feet and I couldn't think clear. "Maybe a little liquor will stimulate her heart," Hank said. It still surprised me that he had learned to take care of the little baby. Most men are scared of new babies and don't want to hold them the way they do bigger children. But Hank had had to take care of little Delia when I was sick, and he was as worried as I was. He kept the fire going in the fireplace all day and all night, even though it was late spring. Since Delia couldn't eat much, it was like she was living on the warmth from the fire. "I'd be afraid to give a baby that little any liquor," I said. "I've heard of giving baby mint tea with a drop of brandy in it," Hank said. "We don't have no brandy," I said. "A drop of liquor will serve just as good," Hank said. There was some peppermint out beyond the wash pot on the way to the spring. I sent Hank out to pick a panful, and I put the green leaves in the oven to dry. The leaves filled the house with the smell of mint as they cured. It was a kind of medicine smell. I took them out before they could burn or bake. As soon as I boiled the tea, I asked Ma Richards how much liquor I should mix in. "Just a few drops," Ma said, "in a tablespoon of tea." I fixed up the tea and put it in the eyedropper Ma had used to feed Delia milk. I held the tip of the eyedropper to the baby's lips and squeezed out a drop in her mouth, then another. She twitched a little, but didn't open her eyes. Her lips was pursed for nursing. It made me ache that I couldn't nurse her. "The mint will soothe her stomach," Ma Richard said. I dripped several more drops into Delia's mouth, and a little color appeared in her tiny cheeks. Maybe the tea was working to make her stronger. When I got up in the middle of the night to look at the baby, I didn't think anything was wrong at first. The baby was usually quiet and still. I thought of warming up more of the tea. I thought of mixing a little liquor with sugar water to give her. I brought the lamp to the mantle of the fireplace and set it down. The baby was quiet in the shoebox. I looked closer and seen her eyes was closed and there was no color in her cheeks. "She needs some more tea," I thought. I put my hand on her forehead, and it was cold. "I need to build up the fire," I thought. And then it come to me that Delia's little forehead was really cold. I pulled back the blanket and took her little hand, and it was cold as an icicle. And I knowed she was dead. "This is the worst thing that has ever happened to you," I said to myself. "If you live to be 90, this is the saddest moment you will ever know." It was so sad, I couldn't really feel it. I would feel it later, maybe. Now it was happening to somebody else. It was sadder than when my senior died and when Papa died, but I couldn't feel a thing. I sat down by the fire and looked at my baby. In a few seconds, I would have to go tell Hank, and he would go tell Ma Richards. But I wanted to wait a moment. If I didn't tell nobody, it might not be true. Maybe Delia would start to breathe again. Maybe my life wouldn't come to a stop the way it seemed to have. "Jesus, don't let this be true," I prayed. I thought how helpless and innocent Delia was. I thought how cruel it was to bring a little person like her into the world to suffer and then die. never knowing anything else. What kind of world would let such a thing happen? But I put it out of my mind, because I had to go tell Hank. I couldn't bear such grief on my own. There was a numbness in my belly that reached out toward my toes and to the tips of my fingers. After Preacher Gibbs come to the house and preached a little funeral in the living room for Delia, and after we buried her in a corner of the orchard and a little oak box Hank had fixed from planks he found in the barn, I felt different from what I expected. I felt like nothing was real, and I was so light I couldn't hardly touch the ground. I scrubbed the floor of the house to make things seem more real, and I carried water from the spring and washed all the bedclothes. I hoed out the tater patch, making myself sweat. The harder I worked, the lighter I felt. When I talked, it didn't sound like my voice talking, and when I thought, it seemed like somebody else thinking. Finally, I just sat down on the porch in a rocking chair and waited for my weight to return to myself. "Do you want me to start supper?" Ma Richard said. "You can if you want to," I said. "What would you like me to fix?" Ma said. "Whatever there is to fix," I said. The next day, Hank drove Ma Richards back up the mountain. I hugged her before she climbed in the buggy, and I told her I loved her. There wasn't nothing else to say after the way she had helped out with little Delia and after the way she had acted after our fuss. What she had done had showed her love for Hank and me. But even so, it relieved me that she was going. I felt better because she was leaving, and I would have the house to myself. Soon as the buggy drove out of the yard, I got a bucket of warm water and a rag and washed the steps. I scrubbed the front steps and the back steps until they sparkled, and I scrubbed the front porch and the back porch until the planks was raw. Then I swept the yard so clean the dirt glittered like sandpaper. I took a bucket to the creek and got some fresh white sand and sprinkled it over the front yard and the backyard. The ground looked frosted with sugar. I tightened the clothesline and washed the outhouse. Then I washed the outside walls of the house high up as I could reach. That evening, I started cleaning up the house inside. I washed the floors and the walls and the windows. I polished the windows so clean they looked like they wasn't there. It seemed I didn't have control over nothing in the world except the work I'd done. I couldn't make nothing right, but I could make the floor and the dishes shine. I washed off the cook stove when it cooled and polished it. I want to make one little place in the world as bright and tight as a crystal, I thought. I want to make one tiny place as fit as it can be. After I polished the stove, I shined the silver, and then I polished Hank's Sunday shoes and my own with saddle soap. By the time Hank come back that night, I was wore out, but the house sparkled. I'd even washed the ceilings and the backs of the doors. Later that month, after I'd recovered my strength a little, I planted every seed I could find on the place. And in the South Carolina heat and in the moist soil along the creek, they sprouted and growed fast. I planted bunch beans and half runners, greasy backs and Kentucky wonders. I planted peas and lettuce and okra, bell pepper and red pepper. I planted squash and eggplant and turnips. The summer squash growed like little yellow geese, and the winter squash swelled like pincushions. I planted watermelons and mushmelons in the soft loam along the creek. The more I worked, the more I had to work. I would give the preacher potatoes and carrots instead of any tithe, and I would help anybody else I could. I would give people that passed on the road new taters and squash. Every time I thought about Delia, I worked that much harder. I mowed the grass on the bank by the road with the sling blade, and I trimmed back the briars and brush and big weeds. We didn't have enough money for shoelaces, but everything I'd done was free. The sweat was free as water from the spring, as air and sunlight. But the greatest free gift was time that kept coming day after day. It seemed that time couldn't go on after the death of little Delia, but it did. Every day led to another night, and night to another day. Time kept spilling down on me, and the only way I could take hold of the minutes and make sense of them was to work.
"You'll kill your fool self," Hank said, but he didn't say it ugly.
He hadn't been able to find a job. He had asked in Tigerville, and he had asked in Pumpkin Town. I guess word had got out that he hit the boss at the cotton mill in Lyman, as he had feared, because nobody would hire him. Hank worked on the place as hard as I did. He put in a big field of corn and a field of sweet taters. He set out a row of tobacco he got from George Poole on credit, and he plowed around the trees in the orchard and did some pruning. The watermelons we growed by the creek was better than any watermelons I'd ever seen on the mountain. He carried rocks on the sled and lined the branch in the pasture so the banks wouldn't wash away. He patched up the fence with pliers and pieces of wire found in the barn. He cleared out the hayloft and the corn crib. The fact that he didn't have money to buy nails and paint made him work even harder. In late summer, I helped Hank cut tops in the August heat. We stacked the corn tops in shocks in the field to cure, and in the September heat, we pulled the fodder and carried it in bundles to the barn. The fodder made the barn smell sweet as green tea. We gathered apples and made cider in an old mill found in the tool shed. I cut up apples and dried the slices on sheets in the sun to make pies in the winter. While we worked that summer, we attended every prayer meeting and church service, every singing and dinner on the grounds. I carried taters and cider and canned preserves to shut-ins and old folks. I made jelly and canned beans and peaches and tomato juice. I canned blackberry juice and grape juice. The days was thick and cluttered with grief, and I fought my way through every minute with work. I wrestled with every job like it was a demon or an angel, and I picked my way like climbing from rock to rock on a tricky path. It was my sweat and my effort that made time possible. When I seen another woman with a baby, I turned my face away, and then I took hold of myself and tried to be glad for her. I was down on my knees weeding the okra when I heard somebody holler from the road. It was a voice I recognized quick. My knees hurt from the sharp clods, but the pain the voice drove through my chest was worse.
"Pendergast," the voice called.
I hoped Hank didn't hear him. Timmy Gosnell had left us alone since Hank throwed him in the creek. Timmy was only trouble when he got bad drunk. I had seen him walk by on the road from time to time, and I doubt he was ever cold sober. But he only got to thinking about Mr. Pendergast and the ginseng money when he was terrible drunk. I kept working, bent over where I was hid by the sweet corn and tomato plants. Maybe Timmy would go on down the road if nobody paid him any mind.
"Pendergast,"
he hollered again, and I heard a rock bang the side of the house. I prayed he didn't break a window, because we didn't have money to buy a new one. Another rock rung on the porch, making me wince.
"You owe me money,"
Timmy yelled. I feared what might happen if Hank got riled again. Since the baby died, Hank had been in a quiet mood, but I didn't know what he would do if Timmy made him mad. I knowed I had to get Timmy to leave before Hank hurt him. Hank was down in the patch by the branch, hoeing sorghum cane. I stood up and seen Timmy Gosnell standing at the corner of the house. He leaned over with his hands on his knees to steady himself, and then he reached down for another rock. I was dizzy from being bent over so long, and I took a deep breath.
"You owe me money," Timmy called out to the house.
"You know Mr. Pendergast is dead," I said as calm as I could. Timmy whirled around and almost fell over. His shirt was unbuttoned, and he looked sunburned as if he had been laying asleep in the hot Gap Creek sun. He shaded his eyes to look at me.
"Pendergast owes me money," he said.
"Can't you understand? Mr. Pendergast died last fall," I said, trying to sound quiet and reasonable.
"Then you all," he said and pointed at me, You all owe me money. If I had any money, I'd give it to you, I said. You have to, Timmy said, and took a step toward me. I backed away. I didn't like his smell, and there were sores around his eyes. He looked both confused and angry. I held out my hands covered with dirt and weed stains. See? I ain't got any money, I said. You will pay me, he said, and stomped his foot on the baked ground. You go on home, I said. I knowed he lived in an old house by himself way back in the holler of Hominy Branch. It seemed strange that all he thought about when he got drunk was that Mr. Pendergast owed him a dollar or two. Ain't treated me square, Timmy said, and shook his finger at me. He blinked like he was having trouble seeing in the bright sun, and when he lurched forward, I took another step back. Ain't treated me square, he hollered and shook his head. Just then I seen Hank coming up the trail from the spring with a hoe on his shoulder. You better go, I said to Timmy. Hank will be mad. Ain't afeard of him, the drunk man said. Hank walked right up to Timmy and stopped, resting the hoe like a staff on the ground. He was so sweaty from work his shirt stuck to his shoulders. I told you not to come back here when you was drunk, he said. You owe me money, Richards, Timmy said. How you figure I owe you money, Hank said. Mr. Pendergast is dead. 'Cause you got all Pendergast's money, the drunk man said. I ain't got a cent, Hank said. He didn't seem scared like he had before when Timmy come. He wiped the sweat out of his eyes. You go on home, Hank said. I ain't afeard of you, Timmy snarled and leaned toward Hank, squinting with one eye. His face was peeling from sunburn. Don't want you to be afraid of me, Hank said. Timmy stepped back as if trying to understand what Hank had said. He was used to people hollering at him. He studied the ground for a few seconds and then looked around. You're a goddamn liar, he said. We don't want to talk that way, Hank said. He lifted the hoe, but let the end drop to the ground again. Timmy swung around and pointed at me. Her too, he said. You're both liars. I seen how much the drunk man wanted a fight. He wanted to be beat and bloodied and throwed in the creek. It was what he had come for. He wanted to be hurt and humbled. Hank must have seen it too. We want to do the Christian thing, Hank said. Don't talk to me no Christian, Timmy said, and swung his arms as though swatting a fly. I ain't got no confidence. We could give you some coffee and cornbread, Hank said, and if you stay a while, Julie can fix you a bean and a tater. You ain't no preacher, Timmy said, and swung his hand again. You'll feel better if you eat something, Hank said. You're a thief, Timmy said. Don't talk to me no Christian. Nobody took anything from you, Hank said. All my life people has took from me, Timmy said. Well, I ain't got nothing. We could give you some new taters and a mess of beans, Hank said. Timmy looked at the house, and he looked at the sky, like he was trying to think what he wanted to say next. Things had not gone as he had expected. Nobody had knocked him down or threatened him. I know what you all are, he said, coming here and taking Pendergast's money. Everybody knows what you are. We ain't stole from nobody, Hank said, and looked Timmy hard in the face. I was sweating so hard the drops run into my eyes, but my hands was too dirty to wipe my brow. I used the back of my wrist, but it had dirt on it too. I felt I was melting like a tallow candle. You all are going to hell, Timmy said. You and your whore both. It sure feels like hell out here in the sun, Hank said. But Timmy Gosnell would not be humored. He looked at the ground and he looked at Hank. He swung his fist and Hank stepped back, catching Timmy's arm. Dropping the hoe, Hank took the drunk man by the shoulders and turned him toward the road. Time for you to go home, Hank said. Won't go, Timmy said, and braced himself with his feet. "You go on home and we'll pray for you," Hank said. "Don't pray for me," Timmy hollered. He wrenched himself away and turned toward Hank. "I won't let you pray for me," he said. "We'll pray to make you feel better," Hank said. "Like goddamn to hell you will," Timmy said. And then I seen Hank get an idea. I seen when it come to him. All at once he knowed what to do to make Timmy leave. Instead of beating Timmy until he was bloody, which is what the drunk man had expected, Hank said, "I'm going to pray for you right now." He dropped to his knees on the hard ground in front of Timmy. "Don't you pray for me," Timmy hollered. "Lord, we ask your guidance," Hank said, shading his eyes from the bright sun. "Brother Gosnell is in pain and confused. Would you soothe his heart and strengthen his will and show him the way?" Timmy stood froze, listening to Hank pray for him. He started to say something and stopped. He swung his arm as if brushing away a gnat. "Show Brother Gosnell the way to truth. Heal his pain and confusion," Hank prayed, sounding like Preacher Gibbs, "for he is a sinner, as we're all sinners." Timmy took a step back like he was afraid, and then he took another. He looked at me, and then at Hank praying on the baked ground. "Ah," he said, and swung his arm again. Then he turned toward the road and started walking. I watched him lurch toward the bend. When Timmy was gone a ways, Hank opened his eyes and stood up. "If you come back, we'll pray for you again," he hollered. But Timmy didn't look back. He kept stumbling down the creek road until he went round the bend. Hank looked at me and grinned. He had changed since last winter. He had knowed what to do to get rid of Timmy without hurting him. I hugged him with my elbows and wrists, since my hands were so dirty they would smear on his wet shirt. It was a long and late fall after the corn was gathered and put in the crib, after the taters was dug and the apples was picked, after the beets was canned and the fox grape jelly made, the winter squash put in the hay, and the cabbage buried in the hill behind the barn, that Hank took up hunting again. In the summer he had caught trout out of the creek, and we fried them for Sunday dinner. But we hadn't had any red meat since the winter before. After the first frost, Hank killed some squirrels, and I made a stew. And then he killed a wild turkey. In November, he shot a deer, and we had more venison than I knew what to do with. He salted down some of the deer meat and put it in the smokehouse. We didn't have any money, and our clothes was wearing thin, and I kept patching Hank's overalls and mending his socks. His shirts was wore out at the elbows. But you can come to take pride in clean, patched clothes. You take pride in how you can keep things together with no money and just hard work. I was beginning to think about Christmas again, and about going up to the mountains to see Mama and my sisters. There was a knock at the door one morning. It was a frost-tight morning with mush ice in the water bucket on the back porch. I dried my hands on my apron and opened the door. It was Preacher Gibbs and another man dressed up in a high collar and a black overcoat. "You all come on in," I said. The cold air swept in with them. "Julie, this is Mr. Rayford from Greenville," the preacher said.
"Pleased to meet you, sir," I said. "Please, take a seat."
"I represent the heirs of Mr. Pendergast's estate," Mr. Rayford said.
"I see," I said.
"Since his heirs did not know about his death for over a year, they are only now claiming their property," Mr. Rayford said. "I've explained to Mr. Rayford that you and Hank have done a fine job taking care of the place," Preacher Gibbs said.
"I can see that," the lawyer said.
"Won't you all sit down?" I said. I figured this lawyer really did represent the heirs since he was with Preacher Gibbs. The two men sat down and held their hats on their knees. The lawyer opened a leather case and took out some papers. It was the kind of papers that give you a feeling of dread. It was the kind of papers hard for ordinary people to read.
The heirs have authorized me to sell the house for them, Mr. Rayford said.
I see, I said. I hated to tell him we didn't have a cent and was living on the game that Hank shot in the woods and the canned stuff I'd put up in the summer.
And they have asked me to collect rent for the months since Mr. Pendergast died, the lawyer said.
Rent, I said. The words stuck in my throat.
You have had the use of the house and land, as well as the horse and other livestock, Mr. Rayford said.
Mr. Pendergast didn't charge us no rent, I said.
The lawyer had a little powder on his face, and he smelled of some kind of toilet water.
You kept house for Mr. Pendergast, the Reverend Gibbs tells me, the lawyer said. Since his death, the heirs have been owners of this house.
Surely you are grateful that Hank and Julie have took care of the place and the things on the place, Preacher Gibbs said.
I'm only an attorney representing the interests of my clients, Mr. Rayford said. They have asked me to collect back rent and to arrange for the sale of the property.
That does not seem very neighborly, Preacher Gibbs said. This young couple has put a lot of work into the place.
I'm only an attorney, Mr. Rayford said again. My clients are willing to be reasonable. They will settle for $100 in back rent.
We don't have any money, I said, and we don't have no way of getting any.
Then I must ask you to vacate the premises, the lawyer said, and I will ask the sheriff to seize any goods you have in lieu of payment.
He put the papers back in his case and stood up.
I'm astonished, the preacher said to the lawyer. I would be ashamed to treat these people this way after all they have done here. They didn't know how to get in touch with the heirs. Nobody on Gap Creek did.
I'm only an attorney, Mr. Rayford said again.
The lawyer handed me a paper. It was a paper that said Hank and me was being sued for back rent. And under South Carolina law, we was liable to lose all we owned unless we paid the rent.
We don't have no money, I said. I felt short of breath.
Let's pray about this, Preacher Gibbs said.
We stood up in the living room, and Preacher Gibbs turned his face toward the ceiling as he prayed.
Lord, show us what is right, he said. Help us to do your will in this world so that we may earn a place in the next. For we know you are watching our every deed, and every single one of us must face your judgment.
After the preacher and the lawyer had gone, I stood by the fire and looked at the paper like I couldn't understand it, though I understood what it said all too well. I stood there watching the words swell and swim in front of my eyes, until Hank come back from hunting with a rabbit in the pocket of his Mackinaw coat. Hank looked at the page and swung it down like it was on fire and he wanted to put out the flames. He shook the paper till it fluttered like a paper bird. I had not seen such a look on his face for a long time.
Does it mean we will be arrested? I said.
We might, he said.
What can we do? I said.
We'll have to leave, Hank said, early in the morning.
Will we take the horse? I said.
We'll take only what we can carry on our backs, Hank said. We'll only take what we brought here when we come.
And leave all the canned stuff? I said.
We'll leave here the way we come into South Carolina, Hank said.
That evening I cooked a big supper of rabbit and taters and beans and cornbread. I even made a sauce out of dried apples. Since we couldn't take anything with us, we ate everything we could hold. And then we went to bed early, since we would have to get up and leave so early. Once we was in bed, it was like a great weight had fell away. We had been worried so long about the air showing up and about where we was going to live, and now we didn't have to worry no more. We would be leaving. We would be shedding all the worries of Gap Creek and starting out again back up on the mountain. When Hank touched me on the breast, I trembled. I was so freed up and charged by knowing we was leaving that I didn't feel like myself. And Hank was trembling too. It's a man's desire that stirs a woman's desire most.
Hank touched me on the breast, and he touched me on the belly. He touched me between my legs. I seen it was better we was leaving. We would start all over again. We had everything we needed to start again. When Hank climbed on top of me, I cried out. It was like we was going for a long walk over the hills and under the pine trees. I rolled and said something, and he turned and said something. We said things we had never said before. And we walked further and rushed up on cliffs we had never seen before. When he cried out, I was thinking of little Delia, and I had never felt such love before. We had never had such love as we did that night. I felt I had been stretched and growed more than I ever had. I felt time was slowed down and richer. I felt myself soar out over a sparkling river, and I felt myself settle finally down into the warm nest of the bed and Hank's arms. That morning when we left was the coldest of the year. It must have been about 10 above zero, maybe colder. It was dark when I got up and lit a fire in the cook stove. Water on the back porch was froze, and I had to crack the cap of ice in the bucket. We was out of coffee, but I heated up some cider to warm our bellies, along with grits and cornbread and jelly. It was sad knowing I would have to leave most of the jelly and jam I had made, the stuff in the basement, the taters and cider and molasses and corn in the crib. All our work would go to the heirs, except what we could carry in our pockets and on our backs. I made up my mind I would take 3 or 4 jars of jelly. Since we couldn't carry much, it didn't take long to pack. About all we could take was our clothes, which was mostly wore out anyway. Back on the mountain, we would start over again with even less than we had to start out on Gap Creek. With a lamp, I looked over the house for the things I had to take. In the bedroom, I got my comb and brush set, the one Rosie had given me when I was married, and I folded up the quilt Mama had given us. On the mantel, I got the little flower vase that Lou had given me. In the kitchen, there was one frying pan we had brought from Mount Olivet. I tried to recall if I had brought any spice or seasonings when we moved to Gap Creek. I climbed up on a chair and looked on the shelf in the kitchen. It was the shelf where Mr. Pendergast had kept bottles of cinnamon and sage and pepper, and also his liquor and camphor and other medicines. There was the box of Epsom salts and the bottle of oil of cloves. I had picked over the bottles and jars and boxes many times before. There was a little tin that I had never opened because it looked rusty and was covered with dust. It was the kind of tin that might have held tea or snuff at one time. I decided to open the can since I never had before. It was hard to twist the lid because of the rust. I had to set the lamp down and use both hands to wring the cap off. There wasn't nothing inside but some crackly wax paper, the kind tea is wrapped in. I opened the paper and seen something shiny. I held the box under the lamp and seen a gold coin. I fumbled in the paper and found a $20 gold piece. It was Mr. Pendergast's secret bank. The money had been there all the time while we was broke and near starving. "Look at this," I called to Hank. "Where did you get that?" he said. He had gathered his tools up in a sack, along with his extra underwear and overalls. "Mr. Pendergast must have forgot this," I said. "The Lord has blessed us," Hank said. "What do you mean?" I said. "I mean the Lord has give this to us for all the work we have done here," Hank said. "You're not going to give it to the heirs?" I said. "And them willing to put the law on us?" Hank said. I seen Hank was right. The Lord had kept the $20 for us till the last minute, when we needed it most. It was a sign. We was free, and we had something to start over with. "It's a little pay for all the work on this place," I said. I wrapped the coin in the wax paper and put it in my pocket. The little packet felt sweet as if it was sugar, and it felt warm in the cold morning air. I put all my clothes and the clean frying pan and 3 jars of jelly in a pillowcase.
I placed the flower vase in my other coat pocket. There wasn't room for anything else, and there wasn't nothing else we had to take. I didn't have but one pair of shoes, and they was near wore out. I tied a scarf around my head. Hank fed the horse some corn and fodder and turned it out into the pasture. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning and completely dark. The stars was out so bright they seemed just over the treetops. It was so cold, my teeth chattered and wouldn't stop. A shooting star spit across the sky, throwing off sparks. In the starlight, the creek glittered, and I could see skirts of ice around the rocks in the stream. There wasn't a light in all the valley, and the mountains loomed like shadowy animals on both sides of the road. "You'll warm up when we start climbing," Hank said. He had not brought a lantern, so we had to find our way along the road in the starlight. The ruts of the road was froze like wood, and puddles had set under panes of ice. When I stepped on a puddle, it cracked like brittle candy. I knowed I could warm up if I breathed deep and kept breathing deep. The cold bit my nose and stung my face. My breath smoked in the air. Grass and brush along the road was covered with hoarfrost. After about a mile, we started climbing. The road wound along the creek bank and then turned and started up the mountain. I slung the pillowcase over my shoulder and leaned into the climb. When you have to climb, there's nothing to do but pitch in. The only way to climb is slow and steady, to not wear yourself out at the beginning. We had to step over a branch that runs across the road, and we stumbled on rocks that stuck up in the ruts. It was still dark, but you could see a little where starlight come through the trees. Something squalled on the mountainside. "What was that?" I said. "Just a wildcat," Hank said. "Or maybe a painter?" I said. "Just a little pussycat," Hank said. "You want me to call it up?" "Don't you dare," I said, and shivered. I remembered hearing the wildcat on the night my senior died. The climb was warming me up a little, but I didn't feel right. Maybe I'd ate my grits and biscuits too fast. Or maybe we had been walking too fast. I slowed down a little. "Are you tired already?" Hank said. "I just need to catch my breath," I said. "We have a long way to go," Hank said. As the road zigzagged up the mountain, we worked our way from one switchback to another. Every step was lifting us out of the valley. Every step was taking me away from the cove of Gap Creek where little Delia was buried. Every step I took in the dark was raising me back toward the mountain and the rest of my life. The road ahead appeared to go up and up forever into the sky. "How much further is it?" I said. "We're only getting started," Hank said. There was a pain in my belly, like the pain I used to feel in my side when I walked to the store as a girl with Mama. It was an uneasy place that got shook as we walked on the rough road. I slowed down more to keep from jarring my belly. I switched the pillowcase from my right shoulder to my left shoulder. My face was stiff with cold, and my hands was stiff with cold. My left hand was just about numb from gripping the pillowcase. "Do you need a rest?" Hank said. "I'm all right," I said. I felt for the coin in my pocket. Its weight gave me more strength and more hope. But the pain in my belly got worse. I swallowed hard and walked on. I imagined I was drawing energy from the tips of my fingers to walk on the ruts, and that I was drawing strength from my ears and from my knees. I was going to burn up every ounce of fat in my body to climb the mountain. I still had strength I'd never used, and I was going to use it. I was going to leave Gap Creek without looking back. It was still dark as I followed Hank past a waterfall and past a place the branch gurgled along the road. Further on, the woods was open, and you could see down the valley where we had come from. There was a light in a house miles below. My belly felt like it was twisting sideways, but I swallowed deep and kept going. we must have walked for another hour in the dark. I was getting warmer, and the pain in my belly was hot. Suddenly, sour water belched up into my throat and the back of my mouth. I turned my head, and the sour taste flooded over my tongue. I didn't want to be sick when we had so far to go in the cold. I stood still and swallowed hard. It was what I had learned to do to keep from being sick. If I stood still enough, my stomach would settle. I had to slow time down by slowing myself.
"Are you going to throw up?" Hank said.
"I don't think so," I said. "It'll pass." As I waited in the road and got hold of myself, the sourness in my throat went away. When the pain was gone and my belly was calm again, I took a step, and Hank was beside me. It was getting to be first light, so I could see him.
"You hadn't told me," he said.
"I meant to," I said. I was going to tell Hank the day before, when the preacher and the lawyer had suddenly come to the house, but in the excitement of having to leave, I had forgot.
"You'll have to have a cold drink when we come to a spring," Hank said.
I stood very still as another cramp hit me in the belly, but this time it passed quicker. Hank took my hand. He was strong and steady as we started walking again.
"We'll take our time," Hank said. "It's mostly down from here."
I looked around and seen the sun was just coming up over the mountains. We had reached the gap at the state line and was already in North Carolina. The valley was dark below us, but the sky was lit up and the east looked like it was on fire.
"Can you walk?" Hank said.
"Of course I can walk," I said. I felt as weak as a newborn colt, but my strength was coming back as my stomach settled. I steadied myself for a moment before picking up the pillowcase. The red sun slipping over the ridge made me squint a little. My belly felt firm and calm. We started walking again.
The End. You've been listening to Gap Creek by Robert Morgan, narrated by Kate Forbes. Author Robert Morgan came to visit the New York studios of Recorded Books in the spring of 2000, just as recording was being completed. As Kate Forbes and director Nick Landrum worked in an adjacent studio to capture the heartbreaking final moments of Gap Creek, Mr. Morgan talked a while to staffer Denise Longto about the creation of the book. You'll find that interview on the final disc. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Stars for a Light by Lynn Morris and Gilbert Morris, also narrated by Kate Forbes, and On the Occasion of My Last Afternoon by Kay Gibbons, narrated by Sally Darling. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.